You're listening to the Kennel Confidential Podcast, brought to you by the United Tree and Forest Association. I'm your host, Davin Ramage.
I'm your co-host, Chad Wagner.
Let's get into the episode. All right, guys and gals, welcome back to this bonus episode of Kennel Confidential Podcast. We are coming to you with a special Veterans Day episode and a different kind of working dog. We have got Mr. Jesse Bacon with us, who was a Special Force bomb dog handler, and we will give him an opportunity to teach us all about that because I know nothing. Of course, we got Chad here, and Jesse, y'all there?
Yep, I'm here.
Yep, thanks for having me, guys.
Glad you're here. I want to start off, Chad's also a veteran, so I just want to start off. I always try to thank veterans when I can. So thank both of you and every other veteran that's listening. I appreciate your service. I did not serve, so I greatly appreciate what y'all did do.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was an honor. Thank you very much.
So
I guess one of my pet peeves is Veterans Day is for us that made it, Memorial Day is for those that didn't. So I think a lot of people get those confused most of the time.
And Labor Day. It seems like every now and then there's someone throwing veterans in on Labor Day. Maybe it's the flags. I don't know. I always catch at least one person on Facebook. But that is a good point, Chad. So, Jesse, before we jump in too much into the all the really cool stuff with working dogs you did, just so the people listening can kind of get a feel for who they're talking to, just give us a rundown of kind of where you're from, what you do now that you're out of the military, and just kind of let us figure out who we're talking to.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm originally from Mammoth Cave, Kentucky, really in the middle of nowhere. I grew up on a horse riding stables and horseman's campground. We gave guided trail rides and, you know, we had rustic and electric sites. We were bordering Mammoth Cave National Park there. So it was a really unique childhood, you know, getting to grow up with, you know, 54,000 acres in my backyard. It was, you know, more than I could have ever asked for growing up. And, you know, did the military thing, a few things before that, got out of the military, you know, I got my real estate license, got into that. And currently I do that. I do a lot with classic cars. I do body work and paint, guns, all that common stuff that comes from the military, some of that residual, you know, anything I get into. I like to stay busy. You know, I'm very outdoors and, you know, I got three pups myself here and I, you know, spend as much time I can with them. I'm always a fan of the canines, you know.
I remember you telling me you were going to train one of them to find, was it your car keys or money? That's what it was, money. Did you ever have any success with that?
You know, I haven't went down that rabbit hole yet. I thought it'd be a good way to find some treasure. I mean, you could teach a dog to find anything, really. I'm sure somebody's tried it at some point, but you'd have to know where to point them in the right direction to get them searching in the first place.
I just take them to the park, Walmart parking lot, the mall.
There you go, maybe some beaches.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So
your training aids at you're into guns and classic cars. I don't think you'd have any training aids left.
You'd be out of money.
Yeah, if you find that money. Well, that's why I need to find it, you know.
So Jesse, I've known you for a few years now, but I don't think I knew that you were from Mammoth Cave, Kentucky. So if anyone ever asks you if you're born under a rock, you almost kind of were.
Yeah, I mean, I'm close too. Yeah, close too. I was born in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains, though. You know, I always tell people in New York and they automatically go to the city, but we were up there in, you know, in Bear Country. So it was a little more rural than actually, you know, Kentucky where we moved. But I was so young, I essentially, you know, was raised in Kentucky. I claim it.
I don't blame you. I'd rather claim Kentucky than New York anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Jesse, what led you to serving in the Army?
You know, that's a good question. I was getting out of high school. I was still in high school at the time, and I had an interest to go to the military. I actually had signed up for the Marine Corps and was in the delayed entry program for a while there in high school. You know, and I was getting out, and I kind of was, you know, making a decision point. You know, I had the thought, you know, I could go into the Army. Once you're in the Army, you're locked in. You know what I mean? You're under contract. You're not leaving. So if I join the, you know, or the Marines, I should say, if I joined the Marine Corps and I, you know, I couldn't get out, but if I did a regular job, I didn't like it, I could always, you know, quit that and go to the Marine Corps. So, you know, overall I was just like, hey, you know, let me give it a little bit more time and, you know, see what I want to do. And I kind of, you know, bounced around a little bit, I did a couple things. I was a certified Harley Davidson mechanic. I went to Phoenix for a little while there. I went to a Motorcycle Mechanics Institute and did that gig for a while. That was fun, you know, made my hobby my job kind of thing. And I think the last job I worked at was a Polaris in Victory. I got laid off. Long story short, I ended up getting introduced to a gentleman, and he owned a oil and gas brokerage. And I got a job there. I was good with people, good on the phone. Not to set the expectation too high on here, you know, but I took the job. I got my Series 22 and 63, and I was an oil and gas investment banker for a while there. Short time, under a year. It was, you know, a little too greedy for me. I wanted to be a guy getting the call. You know, I wanted to be the guy that had the money, not the guy begging for it. So I kind of like that, you know, that homeless dog game where you go up to 100 people and 99 of them kick you in the face and one guy takes you home and feeds you. And, you know, I just, I guess I was just too young for it. Wasn't really wanting to, you know, go down that route. At that point, when I left that, you know, company, I was just at a loss, you know, kind of restarting all over again. I wasn't going to go back and work on bikes. So, you know, I needed something new. And then the military thing, of course, like I had said originally, you know, I always had the option to go back in. And at that point, I had gotten some tattoos. I had a full sleeve, you know, I had one going on my neck and one on my hand. And so I went to the recruiting office. And so, you know, you know how you walk in, you remember how they're all like the four offices are all, you know, around each other there. And all the glass doors, you know, facing you. And I went to the Marine Corps office first, and they put me in the dress jacket because my tattoo was coming above, you know, up my neck there. They wouldn't take me. I went over to the Navy office. My father was Navy. He was the first crew on the USS Enterprise, the first nuclear carrier. He got to do the world tour. You know, he joined the Navy and did what everybody thinks they're going to do when they join the Navy. He got to travel all around. So I thought that would be cool. So, you know, with the, you know, maybe the possibility of going, you know, becoming a Navy SEAL. And they wouldn't take me either. Same reason, tattoos. And I was making my way to the Air Force office, and the gentleman was standing at the glass door on the other side and saw me walking up and just went ahead and pointed over to the Army office. So I walked in there, and they signed me right up. I knew going in that I wanted to, after speaking to a few friends of mine, I had an ex-Ranger buddy, and you know, he always was real, just a real wide-eyed guy, kind of like he'd seen some stuff. You know, it always kind of fascinated me, kind of what, you know, the world he had experienced. So I thought it would be, you know, I thought it'd be unique, and I wanted to go into the Army. I wanted to, you know, become a Ranger, and I was talking to a recruiter, and they signed me right up. And I actually went in just infantry. I didn't get any contract, you know, to go Ranger specifically or anything like that. And, you know, went right into the infantry. The Army will take you.
You know, I kind of have a similar story. My cousin went in the Marines, and I'd quit school at 16, got my GED a week later, went to work, and decided at 18 I wanted to go in. Well, I was wanting to go in the Marines because he did. So I went to a Marine recruiter, and, you know, he's like, I said, you know, I've got a GED. He said, you got post-secondary school, you know, college or trade school. And I was like, no, not really. Well, we can't do anything with you. I went and talked to the Army guy, and the Army guy's like, you got a GED? Yeah. You got any post-secondary? Nope. He said, well, come with me. We'll go see if we can't fix that. He said, what have you been working at? Carpentry. So he just happened to know a guy in the local trade school that was taught carpentry. So I went to his class a few times, and he sent me out on a couple of jobs and filled out some paperwork, and I was good to go. So kind of a similar story, you know, Marines wouldn't take you, Army would. So,
yep.
Well, my granddad too, which he didn't hardly talk at all either, but my mom will tell the story on him. I did not serve, but, he served in Korea, so I don't even know what year this was when he enlisted. He was Navy, and kind of his running joke was him and some buddies piled in a car, and they lived in Princeton, but they had to go to, I think it was Hopkinsville, which, of course, this was all pre-interstates and everything. So they loaded in the truck, and they were going to Hopkinsville to the recruiting office, and they were going Army. But when they got there, the Army recruiter was out to lunch, and the only guy in was the Navy recruiter, and they decided, well, we're here. We're not going to Princeton and going back to Hopkinsville again. We're already here, so I guess we'll go talk to this Navy guy. So him and his buddies enlisted in the Navy because everybody else was out to lunch.
That's one way to make life decisions, you know?
Yeah.
So how long did you stay in, Jesse?
11 years. It was in 11. I did just under four years in the infantry. I was SWOT leader, E5 promotable. And then I dropped my packet to go to the, to go to selection. And, you know, when I got done with that, I dropped the packet to go to the Q course. And I spent about 6 years or so, maybe a little over 6 years there at Fort Campbell.
Is that where, once you went through selection, is that where you ended up becoming a handler?
Yeah. So, you do selection there in North Carolina and you kind of come back. And, you know, if you get picked up, you still have the choice. You know, some people go to selection, they get picked up, but they decide they just want to stay with their unit. So I decided to pick it up and I went to North Carolina, Fort Bragg there to go to the Q course. So, you know, a year and a half or so. Fifth Special Forces Group there in Fort Campbell is where I went right after that and spent all my time. You got fifth group there at Campbell, you got seventh in Florida, so on and so forth. And everybody really wants the Florida does all of South America. You know, all the groups have different regions of the world they operate in. Okay. Fifth group is of course the Middle East with Bragg as well. And Florida does all South America and all that, which you'd imagine would be a little bit funner, atmosphere as opposed to the desert. So everybody's trying to go to a couple of those, those different places. And I put in for Fort Campbell and I was probably one of a few that made it the number one on my list because that's where I was from originally, And so I got it easily. It wasn't the top of everybody else's list. And it's, it's the flagpole. So it's really like the headquarters for Special Forces. It's everybody's got the haircuts and uniforms. It's you have to be a little more proper on Fort Campbell than the other installations, for the most part. Don't hold me to that, but
Yeah, the Army's always got some kind of joke going, so you're either going to go to Florida and be in the sand or go someplace else and be in the sand. So
I was leaving El Paso to go live in the sand more. When I went to El Paso there, I was at Fort Bliss. And right when I had gotten there, they had moved 1/6 Infantry from Germany to Fort Bliss, and we picked up the Army Test Brigade mission, which just meant, the divorce rate was like people getting, going on deployment. Because we were in the field 6 months out of the year, if not more. Testing equipment, different companies, trying to sell stuff to the Army. And we would go out and we would do, some different scenarios. We'd live out there. We'd work the equipment and see, what the faults were. We were really there to test it to see how capable these different, things were. So it was a unique position to go into the Army right out the gate and then get, this opportunity to go test all this unique equipment and really get a lot of field time. Tons of desert, White Sands Missile Range there in New Mexico. Ate a lot of that sand, and then I kicked over to the Middle East. So I went to group. So I'm very, very sand friendly.
I'm not a sand friendly person.
Oh, I have a real relationship with it, down to just the feeling of putting ear pro in your ears and grinding your ears to the inner ears to pieces with sand. It's like sandpaper over time. All those little things, I could watch a movie and we're taking two different things from it,
You can feel the movie.
I noticed just how uncomfortable they are.
So when I was in Germany, and when you're in Germany, they don't want to send you back to the States for any schools at all. So I think but you had to be E4 or E4 promotable, at selection to actually go to school. Of course, they come around and I actually got to go through selection, but I was E3. So I wasn't able to go. They said they would have picked me, but they couldn't because, you wasn't ranked high enough to go to school. So I didn't get to do that. So tell us a little bit about school if you can.
Yeah. The selection phase.
No, Ranger school.
Oh, the Ranger school. Yeah, I'll tell you, man, I talk about this all the time. I really love my Ranger tab. I love my SF tab, don't get me wrong. The Q course is really over a year and a half, So you go into a cycle of something. Like language school is 6 months, and then before that, you had a week or so where you're transitioning. So it's a lot of time. It wasn't just very one thing after another. And Ranger school is the direct opposite. It was still very much Vietnam era fighting tactics. It was all very in the woods, no sleep, no food. You woke up every morning with simulation grenades. I got to tell you, it's a really unique experience. You get pushed to the limits. I think a lot of people don't know, a lot of stuff that goes on there probably. Because it's not necessarily always a good look. You have very little nutrition while you're in there. You'd be surprised though at how little you need to operate, how little sleep you need, how little food you need to really keep going and going, you know. You go a while without sleeping, you could take a 5-minute power nap, you know, and then you're back up and you feel like you're 100%. I'm sure you're very far off of 100%, you know, in reality, but you feel great, you know. But it was a unique experience, man. I wouldn't take it back, you know, getting out there in the woods and doing real ambushes and raids and all that stuff. You learn a lot. You know, what I took from Ranger School is I went into Ranger School as an E5. I think I might have been a team leader at that time. And, you know, I knew a lot. I could run a squad, so on and so forth. I don't think at that time before Ranger School I could have led a platoon in combat. You know, there's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of stuff to know. But I'll tell you, when I got out of Ranger School, I could lead an entire platoon overseas. I could run missions. I could just do everything. So just the knowledge you got, for actual operational knowledge you got from Ranger School, is really second to none. Something to be said, too, about the cadre. The cadre at Ranger School, a lot of them are volunteers. So it's guys that pick up and say, you know, hey, it's my time. I want to go be an instructor at this course. So everybody there is very motivated. The instructors are happy to be there. They want to be there. They're there for a reason. When they wake you up in the morning, they tell you a war story that they experienced or you know, somebody they know experienced, and it just puts things in perspective for you right after the simulations, you know, simulation grenades go off.
perspective.
Interesting. Yeah, give you some perspective, you know. It's like they give you a why you're there pretty much, you know, every morning while you're out there in the field, you know, sucking. But I was there for it's a 62-day school. I'm proud to say I was there for 105 days. I pretty much PCS moved to Ranger School. I remember being in Florida phase on the back of a Zodiac in the middle of a swamp, getting, you know, hit in the face with a dude's rifle in front of me and just paddling away, you know, storm coming in. And I was just like, yeah, this is my life now. I just permanently moved to Ranger School. Like, this is just what I'm going to do for a while. But yeah, no, it was great. I made it all the way straight through to Florida. You do Darby first there in Benning, then you go to Mountain Phase in Dahlonega, Georgia, which is just a real beautiful place. I was zombie mode most of the time. I remember, you know, kind of waking up and seeing some cool waterfalls, and then I kind of zombied back out, but pretty tired at that point. But Florida there in Camp Rudder, made it all the way there. And we were about a day away from coming back, finishing up the field problem. You know, we jumped into that one. So we did an airborne drop into it. We're in the field for a couple of weeks and we're about to come out. I saw a group of my team. I had one other enlisted guy on my squad and the rest were all officers. And I saw them all standing around a circle and there was a bunch of ammo in the middle of them. And I walk up and I was like, hey guys, what's going on? And they're like, oh, well, you know, my bag's full. And they were just arguing over who's going to carry this ammo, because they're all saying they divvied it out already. Nobody wants to carry anymore. And I was a little too aggressive. You know, I went up to him and said a few words and said, you know, come on, we're almost done. Let's just put this in your bags. And I shoved a bunch in mine. And I said, let's just get this done. And they took that pretty harshly. I did make friends of them right there at the end. You know, everybody's tired and hungry at this point. We did our last mission and you walk right back to camp. You do a march back to camp, and you get back to camp. They walk you right into the building and you do peers. You know, a lot of Ranger School is a peer system. You know, every once in a while they'll sit you down, you fill out cards, you know, you can pink slip somebody. So if somebody, you know, you don't like somebody there, you have a problem. It's kind of a way for the instructors when they're not around to feel out the, you know, their students, you know, which is good and bad, you know, because, you know, in this situation it was bad for me. But, you know, if they listened a little too much to people just complaining, they could get a wrong impression of somebody. So it has its faults. So we come back and they all, you know, still no sleep. They all peered me pretty bad for that last little comment there that I had made, because I was just on their hit list. They were tired and they're all hungry and sleepy. And, you know, you're just very primitive brained at that point. So they peered me pretty hard. We go to sleep and wake up the next morning. And two of the officers came up and, after getting some good sleep, apologized to me for peering me. As I said, they were just mad about it. And I was like, no, let's go to the board, because I'm about to have to recycle this, you know. And he was like, no, we can't do that, you know. We're not going to go back on what we said. And I was like, all right, let's go. Cool. We'll just stay here then. And the whole time during Ranger School, I was chasing a three-week cycle break. You know, they alternate going on I forgot what time of the year it was, but they alternate on going on breaks. Each school, right, takes 3 weeks off. And when I would leave to go to Benning, then I was going to Mountains, they would Benning was then going on break, right? And then when I was leaving Mountains going to Florida, then Mountains went on break for 3 weeks. So this was chasing me the whole time. So if I recycled, I had to wait 3 weeks anyway. You know, so I didn't, who wants to do that? You know, 3 weeks in Ranger School. So that's what I had to do. I did stay there 3 extra weeks and did objective maintenance. And they just kind of, they pull a bunch of people together, everybody that recycles, and they, you know, clean up all the objectives, and they do, you know, different things they need done, building, you know, a lot of filling sandbags and stuff like that. It's good, cheap labor, you know, well, you got a bunch of guys there. and they let you have care packages. So I got, you know, I got skinny fat for a minute, which is cool. It was the most food I had in a minute. And then I had to go right back into the phase, which is pretty horrible to go right back into the phase after you got skinny fat. But that was it. Yeah. Yeah. So I went right back in and that went flying colors all the way through. Appeared like a 90 that time because I made sure not to make anybody mad. I learned that life lesson, you know.
Much more friendly about the ammo that time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was much more patient. I just picked it up and just didn't say anything. You know, it was, as a matter of fact, at my graduation, one of those officers actually came to my graduation to say congratulations. And I thought that was really cool of me, really. You know, he didn't have to do that. The same guy that peered me and made me stay. So that was pretty cool of me.
Trying to get the egg off his face is what he was doing.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
So after Ranger School, that's when you went into the Green Berets?
Yeah. Yeah, I went a little bit after. When I was in basic, I just had I just was going infantry. And before we were graduating basic, I had pulled the drill sergeant aside and said I wanted to pick up airborne school, you know, because I was trying to go to Ranger school. And I said, so if you give me airborne school, when I get to airborne school, I'll bug them about trying to get a Ranger slot, you know. And he said, all right, he's like, well, if you get, you know, I think a 300 is the max on the PT test. And, you know, basic there. He's like, if you max out the PT test, I'll bring in an airborne recruiter and sign you up. And I was like, all right. I was like, let's do it. So the last PT test, I did like a 305 or something like that. He stuck to his word, brought an airborne recruiter. And let me tell you, I had orders to Fort Carson, Colorado, okay, which I've never heard anybody talk bad about. It's one of the best duty stations from my experience, right? And I've never been there. But I've just never heard anybody say something bad about Colorado. So when I picked up airborne school, it gave me undeclared airborne orders. So I went to airborne school, did that. And then when I got done with airborne, I got orders to Fort Bliss, Texas. And I was like, because I figured if I get airborne, maybe I'll get Germany, I'll get Italy, I'll get Fort Bragg. I went to a non-airborne unit in Fort Bliss. It was picking up infantry with mechanized. So I was even more of a, yeah, we call them legs, but I was even more of a guy on the ground at Fort Bliss there because I was a Bradley dismount. So I rode in the back of just a really big tomb.
The infantry guys just cram in a Bradley.
Hey, it's terrifying. and not a lot of air, man. If you got a guy that's been a little stinky that day, worked a little too hard, it's a rough ride back. You know what I mean?
That's when I was in. I was a scout in a Bradley. So we only had two of us back there.
Oh, so you guys could kick back.
Yeah,
it fits about six. Yeah, yeah. Just for the listeners who don't know, it fits about six. It's just two metal benches in the back of this tiny tank, is really what it is. And there's just little peepholes that you can open up. But you know, if you open up those peepholes, it's just gonna throw sand in there on you. You're just gonna be chewing sand the whole time. So it's loud, dirty, and
smelly.
Yeah, pretty aggressive and smelly at times. Yeah. We'll go back to airborne school. I went there and I kept going up to the guys there saying I wanted to go to get a Ranger spot. And he said, we're not taking any infantry. And I was like, what do you mean not taking infantry? Who else goes to Ranger battalion, you know, than infantry? I was like, this doesn't make any sense to me. And I went in there about four times. And the fourth time, he pretty much cussed me out the door and told me not to come back. He's like, you're going to whatever you know we sent you to. And I was like, all right, whatever. Yeah, so I get to Fort Bliss. I ended up picking up air assault school at some point there. I went and did air assault school. We had EIB came up. That's Expert Infantryman's Badge, which is really just it's just a testing of all your knowledge as an infantryman. So they set up lanes. You have a little bit of time to learn. You know, you have a week or two to learn all these different things or refresh on all these different things. And then you run a lane that just tests all those skills in, like, you know, three different scenarios, you know. So if you pass that, you get your expert infantry badge. Another cool thing you get to add to your uniform, you know. So I did that. And then that earned me
the eligibility with my first sergeant to be able to go to Ranger School. So once I had those, the triple sack, he was going to let me try to go get a tab. And and then I went to Ranger School from there. When I got out, I was a squad leader for a while, and I was hitting about my 4-year mark where I did a 4-year contract. So I was coming up on my time in, and I had a buddy come up to me and he said, "Hey, listen," he's like, let's go to selection. He's like, "Go to selection with me." And I was like, "All right." I was like, "Well, you know," he's like, "You're going to regret it. If you don't go, you're going to regret it." I said, "You're right. I'm going to regret it if I don't go. Just at least give it a try." I was like, "Even if I pass, I don't have to go, right? I'm just going to go to selection. If I don't pass, then so be it." So I was like, "All right, let's sign up." We were going to like kind of try to go together, right? So I go in, I do all my paperwork, and a couple of days later, my buddy calls me. I'm like, "Hey, man, I'm ready to go." I was like, "This is my date. I'm leaving." I was like, "What about you?" He said, "Hey, I just found my wife's pregnant." He's like, "I'm not going." I said, "Well, it looks like I'm going by myself." So then I went to selection from there.
Well, what got you into Special Forces and bomb dog handling?
Yeah, so I was on a team for a while there. I did when I first got to group, I first for the 5th group, my team was about to kick out to Iraq. They jetted. I had some passport stuff to work out, so they went to Iraq, and I was waiting to get all that done. And then I kicked off and went and did a trip. So I went to a camp there, had a good time. I was by myself. I was the only SF guy on the camp. I was the weapons guy there. We were training, you know, counterterrorism force, so on and so forth. I was on a mission, and we were in a town, and there was an IED cell in this town, and we wanted to go, and we were going to pull them out. So we got our local forces, and we did we actually called in another group from a different area to kind of meet us there so we could do a big show of force and really just like go in this town and pull everybody out and see who's who. And we did that, and we lined every man, woman, child up, and, you know, they were all, you know, sitting up against the wall there in town. Even construction workers were there. It didn't matter who you are. We pulled everybody out. And there was a dog handler there, and I was protecting, I was kind of standing by one of the command there, walking around with him, just pulling some personal security for him. And we went over, and we were by this dog handler, and I watched this guy. He had a muzzle on his dog, and there was kids lined up, you know, against the building. They're like teenagers, you know, to be fair. And he was just sending the dog on them and muzzle thumping them. And if you're not familiar with the Middle East, you know, dogs there are not, they don't have the same image of dogs we do. You know, dogs there are wild. Most of them are running in packs. Nobody takes care of dogs there. Most of them, when they see a dog, they kick it. You know, I got to brief everybody when I get there, you know, overseas. Hey, you touch my dog, we're going to have a problem. Like, this isn't just some dog you get to kick or, you know, so on and so forth. So they're also terrified of dogs because they're very aggressive there. I mean, they're dog packs there that'll eat you up, you know. So anyway, this guy was just muzzle thumping. If people aren't familiar with that is, when you have a muzzle on, we train like that to send the dog, and the dog goes and just hits the person. You know, it's a good way to – it has training value. Not a super great thing to do on a bunch of teenagers in the Middle East. So I saw that and I had a problem with it. And, I just thought it could be done better. I brought it up to the command, said, "Hey, it looks like we're, you know, making a few more terrorists than we're, you know, taking out." Anyway, that put it in my head. You know, if I see somebody doing something that I don't like the way it's being done, if I feel like I could do it better, it kind of motivates me and drives me to kind of maybe give it a shot and see if I can make it look different, you know? And who doesn't like working with dogs anyway, you know? So I did that trip. I came back. We did an NTC trip, which is a training center in California, in the middle of nowhere. It's a big training center everybody goes to. And we had a canine handler there with us. And I remember going out. We were running these mock missions. And this dude had this dude was like in the back of the truck. He had his canine with him. You know, he just, everything about it was just like, it reaffirmed. I was like, this has got to be a cool gig. You know, I didn't even know much about it. Like, what does a dog handler really do, you know, in the Army? You know, I saw what that guy was doing. You know, I saw this guy, he was operating with his dog, but that kind of really sold me. So when I got back from NTC, I had been on the team for a couple, maybe a few years at that point. And I just decided, you know, I think I want to go do this dog thing. We were coming up on a mission for the team to go work with the CIA. It was like it was good money. It was a couple trips. I think it was like four on, four off, four on type of deal. 4 months on, 4 months off, 4 months on. I think it was two or three rotations. So it was like good pay. Of course, anytime you're overseas, it's all tax free. So I mean, it's good money, you know. But I thought about it and I was like, yeah, you know, if I had all the money in the world, what would I do? Go be a dog handler, you know. So I walked out. I drove down to the kennels on post there, and it's a little bit away from kind of the flagpole there at Fifth Group. They have their own little building. There's only about the capacity is like 12. There's a capacity of 12 dog handlers. I think at the time there was only 8 of them. So, you know, within 5th Special Forces Group, there's only, you know, 8 or 12 at a time dog handlers, and they're singletons. So they'll get attached to teams. They're an attachment. You know what I mean? So you get attached to a team. If a team needs a dog handler, they'll call and you'll go deploy with them. And we can be used by anybody, Navy SEALs, Delta Force, anybody can call us over to use as dog handlers.
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah, very unique. Yeah, I've worked with a bunch of different agencies, I guess you would say, and departments of the military. So, yeah, very unique opportunity it has there. And you're very much on your own, you know. So, anyway, I walk in, I pitched the, you know, the kennel master there. I told him I wanted to come over, and we talked about it. I have had an equine background. You know, and he had told me when I first got there, he's like, you know, the best dog handlers he's ever had were guys that have worked with other animals before, and equine especially. You know, I guess if you can relate to one species, you kind of get to feel out another one. Not so precisely, but, you know, you got a feel of how the drives of an animal work and its behavior. You can kind of feel out all animals. They're all just a little bit different, but they all have drives. They all have all that stuff, you know. So that's what really got me into it. I just really enjoyed. I thought it was really cool. I thought I could do it better than the guy I saw doing it, and figured I'd give it a shot. And he gave me a job. I went back and told the team, and everybody, you know, was really good about letting me transfer over. And I think it was a week later I was already over there.
So how long? And you may have told us a little while ago. I tried to make some notes of time served, but I made bad notes. How long did you serve as a Special Force handler?
So as a Special Forces canine handler, I did. My last 3 years were as a canine handler.
Okay. And your dog's name was?
Priest.
All right. So was Priest the only dog you handled while you were over there?
No, my first dog was Zuppi.
Both Belgian Malinois, I assume.
Both Belgian. Zuppi was a little bit of Shepherd, a little bit of Malinois.
Okay.
And he was just as goofy as his name. Yeah, Zuppi had a problem of not wanting to transition. So when he would want to go from a bite back to looking for bombs. Our dogs are all multi-purpose. So we do bomb work, we do tracking, and we do bite work. Zuppi didn't want to get off the bite and go back to looking for bombs, which is really not great to deploy with. You know, it's like, here's a bite. Okay, go find a bomb. Now I want to go back to the bite.
I can see that being a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing 90% of the stuff I'm doing is bomb, if not 95 or higher. You know, I might have an opportunity to maybe get a bite in here and there, but the focus is bomb work. You just don't want a dog that's just looking to bite. You know, and dogs are like people. Some are smarter than others. You know, if me and you take a math test, we're going to get, you know, you're probably going to get higher than me, right? You know,
dogs, I don't know, that might have been a bad example, maybe.
Well, dogs are the same way. You know, they all have an intelligence level, and some of them just don't have it. You know, and Zuppi just couldn't get the transition. He just couldn't really get it. And I had spent a while with him. I got him from school, did a lot of obedience, did a lot of stuff with him. And he was overall, he was a pretty good dog, but he just had that one thing was the biggest holdup, and he just kind of made him undeployable, at least at that moment for me. And I had been with him for so long there, I needed to get a trip in, you know, I needed to get deployed. So I switched over to a dog that had already been there, a little bit more of a senior dog, and that was Priest.
I got you. So you seen your dog, how old was he, do you remember, when y'all were introduced?
Yeah. So Zuppi was 2, so he was still a little young. Priest was, I believe Priest was about 4 when I got him.
How did the 4-year-old dog, you know, which even me and my tree dogs, I'm really only about 3 years into this, you know, and it's like puppy groundhog day with me because I had my misfortune with the first one. So I'm back on puppy again. When you come in, especially in a military structure, what does bonding look like with a senior dog, a senior working bomb bite driven dog?
So that's a good question. You know, the dynamic between man and his dog, you know, it's a little bit easier with a good senior dog. Usually senior dogs, if the kennel's training them appropriately, The dogs are easily transferred to different handlers. You know, a senior dog has had a lot of exposure, has had a lot of people touch him, a lot of people tell him what to do, and is kind of okay with it, right? So initially you get the kind of the respect out the gate. Anything substantial as far as the real bond between you two, that always takes time to build, no matter what kind of dog it is, no matter what your experience is with, you know, with what you know or what the dog knows. You got to spend time together to get to know each other. It's no different than a human relationship. And you got to help them out. You got to look for opportunities where, you know, I'd take him out and we go out into the woods, you know, out in the back 40 in the, you know, on Fort Campbell there. And I'd find a hill that he couldn't get up by himself. And I'd get behind him and I'd push him up the hill. And, you know, we'd drink water out of the creek together, you know, whatever you could do, yeah, to be like, this is me and you. You know,
that's actually brilliant ideas. I like that.
You have to. It's the core. The first thing, you know, I used to train dogs a little bit there, house dogs. You know, when you first get somebody's dog in, you can't go right into training. The dog doesn't know who you are. I mean, you can do whatever you want, but the best way to go about it is to build a bond with the dogs. Always took the first three or four, and I'm on a timeline too. I'm doing a 2-week training cycle. So, but I take the first 2-3 days of just getting to know the dog, just hanging out with him, you know, find out what he likes, what he doesn't like, you know, figuring out, you know, what his home life is like. You know, you spend I could spend 2 days with your dog, you know, and I'll know exactly how your home life is. If it's high stress, he'll have that kind of attitude. If it's, you know, if you're calm, if you have a calm demeanor at home in a very relaxed house, the dog will be very relaxed. It's very much an emotional, they follow you emotionally. You know, we always say emotion runs down the leash. Well, emotion runs through your house too. It's a great reflection on your dog is probably more of a reflection on who you are than most people would want to admit.
I guess I just kind of picture you. I mean, like you said, you went on the back 40. Are you, I mean, you're just spending all day with the dog. I mean, what are you, I'm sure your job entailed more than that, but I guess that's what I'm trying to get my head around is, I mean, was it constant like mission based training or what were you doing with your time there to bond with the dog?
Yeah, that's another great question. So a lot of people really don't dive into that kind of thing, you know? So we're all group guys. You have to have a few years on a team before you can come to the kennel, right? A kennel is kind of like another duty that you can do instead of going to be an instructor at the Q course, for example, right? Because everybody can only spend so much time on a team before they need to go and be an instructor somewhere. And there was a little bit of a handshake deal that got finalized while I was at the kennel that if you go to the kennel, it kind of counts as that time. So when you get over there, you still go and you're doing your range stuff. You know, I'm still the weapons guy. So when I'm at the kennel, I'm running the ranges and you know, instructing all the shooting and doing all that. My engineers are doing their engineer stuff, or medics are doing medic classes. But everything really, the dogs are there. So our normal day, we'll come in, we'll feed the dogs, we'll let them digest. We load them up. And we go out to a training area. It depends what we're doing that day. There's a lot of facilities on Fort Campbell that we go to, including some schools that are closed down. There's a lot of mock buildings out there, you know, in the middle of some fields that you can go train on and do different scenarios and hide in different manners and places, you know, with bomb stuff. And, you know, if we're doing bite, there's, you know, we go to the school and we'll hide it, you know, in a closet in a bite suit, waiting for the dog to find you, that kind of thing. And then, you know, sheesh, we'll take a break from the dog. We'll give the dogs a break and we'll go out and we'll do some training amongst ourselves. So we'll have like a medical class while we're out and kind of, you know, do that, go back to the dogs a little bit and bring them back and, you know, feed them, and then kind of call the day after that. So it's 5 days a week. And then we switch out the weekends taking care of the kennels because nobody else is going to do it for us. So
I can't find anybody else to take care of my kennel either.
I know, right? That's a typical problem. Yeah, I don't know if you'd want to take care of this kennel. It's a bunch of velociraptors in there. But, yeah. So, I mean, we spent a lot of time. You know, that's why when we go to – when group goes to the Canine Olympics there in Peru, Indiana, at Von Lick Kennels, for example, we'll compete with the, you know, the police officers, their canine detachments, and some other, you know, different people. And we really just, I mean, there's really no competition because we spend every day of the week and we're training, you know, we're training for combat. We're training to go do this stuff in real life. So, you know, we always train harder than we fight. You know, if the training's harder than anything you're going to go see overseas, then you're going to be set up for success. So Yeah, that's really that was really our focus. Get after it as much as we can.
So how many deployments did you and Priest do together?
Me and I got one dog trip before I got out. I deployed with the team, and I deployed as a weapon sergeant. I deployed as a weapon sergeant and canine antler. So the first trip was Iraq. The second trip was Syria with the dog. I went there, I think it was around 2018. I was in Raqqa, the old ISIS capital, right after we pushed them out. And it was a heavy bomb mission. I think I had over 50 some finds while I was there in just that 6 month time span. Wow. So we did a lot. We were there for that push out of northern Syria to get the last of ISIS out of northern Syria. Me and Priest were the first ones to cross that flot in a bunch of years. The flot, by the way, is the forward line of troops. It's essentially it's a real berm that was made with a bulldozer that runs the entire countryside. And it's like, this is the line. And then there's a bunch of white space, and then the enemy has their line, if that makes sense. They obviously have to back up from our line because we shoot mortars and stuff, you know? So there's that gap in between we call white space.
So when you first went to the kennel and you got accepted to come in and transferred over, what type of training, of course, you had the young dog, but what kind of training did you receive to get you started?
So we go to, you know, we worked, I don't know if they've mixed this up since I've been here, but we went to Von Lick kennels in Peru, Indiana. That's where we got our dogs, that group, and that's where we did our training, initial training. So, you know, newbie from a team, no canine experience, you go to Von Lick, you get your dog the second day. Can't remember how long the course was. But you stay there at some dorms they have there across from the bar they call the Red Rocket, which I thought was hilarious. So they give you all the training there. The first of it is really just getting you to learn your dog's behaviors, as well as, you know, Von Lick has really, they've laid a base on the dog, right? And all these dogs' levels are very different. You know, you got like my dog was not that very advanced. He had some obedience stuff. He knew bomb stuff. And a buddy of mine got a dog that was like, you know, you could just press a button. He'd go climb a ladder and go up on the roof. You know, he was a European dog that just dropped out of some European competitions and ended up at Von Lick Kennels. So he was like a push button dog. He already was very trained up. So the dogs are kind of there, but they're going to finish getting there when you get to group. You know, when you go back home is when you really kick the dogs off and learn how fifth group really does it. So you learn the basics from Von Lick, the handling, the casting, the verbiage, you know, all the different commands, all that stuff. And then you go back to group and you learn what we do in-house and how group does things. As we get more advanced, SF has their own, kind of has their own little piece towards the end there. But yeah, for the most part, I was in there with Army Rangers. A bunch of different people from a bunch of different places. Everybody does canine, goes to, you know, a lot of them go to Von Lick.
I know on our dogs, you know, when they pick up what they want to find, in our case of squirrels, of course, we key them into bark. You know, that's what they're supposed to do. What's the behavior on scent of your all's dogs? I mean, do they just lock up like a pointer, or do they bark, or what do you all teach them to do?
Yeah, so for us, what we want to do is we want the dog to stop. We want them to find the source, and then we want them to sit, and we want them to stare at the source as close as he can get to the source. That's what we want. Okay. And what that gives you is he finds it. He legitimately finds it. There's no guess game. There's no, you know, and every dog's better at this than others. But what you want is you want your dog to stop, sit down, and just stare. So the sit is your signal. That's your cue that he's got to find. Okay. And a great dog will just stare at what his source is until you call, you know, until you give him the roar, give him an okay, and throw him the tennis ball, which they do everything for. But yeah, we want to sit and the stare. It's very important that he gets as close to source as possible. You know, we're dealing with IEDs. So if he just is in a scent trail and just goes and sits, and then we go to walk up, we come in from a bad angle and we step on the IED because he's not close enough to it. To identify, that's an issue, you know. It sounds pretty rough that we do want a bomb dog to get right on top of the bomb, but, you know, that's what they're there for.
Well, I know that all dogs have basically the same olfactory, and to those that don't know, that's the how much they can smell or how much scent they can detect. So about all dogs, whether it be a bloodhound or a Malinois, have about the same olfactory. It's how much scent does it take to get them excited. Did you find that with different dogs? Some dog got excited on stronger scent, or some on, you know, not as strong scent. We call it hot and a cold track, basically. Did you find that with these dogs as well?
Yeah, you know, the Malinois, I would argue that they have, for the most part, the same olfactory, system as far as all canines across the board. But there is a reason that we use bloodhounds, you know, police officers use bloodhounds, and we use Belgian Malinois. The longer snout, as opposed to a Chihuahua or a pug, for example, they do have a little bit better of a capability to zero in. They can highlight it a little bit more than, say, a smaller dog with a smaller nose. I mean, just see if you could put it like that. They got a bigger nose, you know? So they could, I don't know whether they're smelling it better. You know, I'll never tell anybody that I know for sure. Because up until somebody gets in the body of a dog and smells like a dog smells and sees like a dog sees, you know what I mean? Everybody's guessing, okay? You know, but yeah, what a lot of people don't know too is that the olfactory system is actually in the mouth too. So when your dog is running around and you're like, oh, he's got his mouth open, he's not smelling nothing, he is. There's actually some holes in the roof of his mouth that go and connect to his olfactory system, which is why if your dog's teeth get dirty, it can affect his smell. So that's just a fun fact to keep in mind.
Just say you're going to see me out there scrubbing Lemon's teeth now.
yeah, that's going to make the smell. But as far as odor's a tricky thing. You know, odor, I love bomb work. I love odor work. Obedience is probably my favorite thing, but odor work, definitely my close second. You know, odor itself is a real, it's a theory that you really, it's an animal in itself. If you imagine, you guys know for Halloween when you have those smoke bombs, those little cheap smoke bombs that you throw out in the grass.
Yeah.
You know, like the blue and the green, right? Yeah. And after they've lit off and it's all kind of gone, well, that blue and green smoke, you kind of walk around and you kind of kick around the grass as it kind of just floats above the ground. That's a good example of how odor works, right? So it's heavier than air, so it wants to fall and it's going to kind of move with the wind and gust around. You know, and with that being said, different amounts of the same odor, they don't smell, they essentially smell a little different. Okay. So that's something we have to work with too, as far as, you know, how did your dog react? So, you know, for example, a pound of TNT, say if TNT is made of four chemicals. Okay. At a pound, the dog is only smelling maybe two of those chemicals, right? Cause it's a small amount of that odor. Okay. So they take it in, they're like, cool, I got a pound, I found it, I know what that smells like. Well, if you put 100 pounds of that same TNT out, he is then going to smell everything that TNT is made of, right? So it's going to throw him off a little bit. It's going to be different. He may even go in and out as he's searching. He may be weaving a little bit, go outside the scent cone, and then come back in because he's kind of confused. You see him maybe loop around a little bit. Like, it's like I'm onto it, but something's weird. Something's a little different. Right. So we have to be able to train with multiple sizes as well. It's not just about training the different types of odors. You also have to consider the amount of odor. And the best thing that was ever created, I believe it was Scent Logics came out with, and I'm not saying that they came out with this first, but I think it's Scent Logics came out with a capability. It's a chemical compound that just comes in a little bag, but it's the equivalent of, say, 100 pounds of that TNT. So instead of us having to carry around 100 pounds of TNT and set it out to hide it somewhere, we can just use this little bag, and it has the same chemical scent as what that 100 pounds would, which is really a clutch thing to train.
They make those for squirrel scents?
I'm not sure. you want to find 100? What if it's 100 squirrels out there? Yeah.
If there's 100, I want to find all of them.
Now, but as far as getting ramped up about the smell, you know, all of our dogs are Malinois, you know, some are Shepherd mixes, but they're all equally ramped up for it, really, because it's all based on that reward. You know, they could be smelling dung for all they know. As long as they're getting rewarded for it, they don't know the difference. I always said if I could tell my bomb dog he's going out looking for bombs, he'd probably quit the next day.
Right.
Yeah. You know, he's like, you just got me walk around out here? Come on.
how many cents was Priest trained on?
Oh, man. A lot. So
C4, black powder, TNT, sodium chloride, potassium chloride, ammonium nitrate, you know, all those breakdowns. And what's unique about that is, you know, we talk about how we train all that stuff, but once you go overseas, everything's going to have a little bit of a different odor too. So then when you get overseas, you kind of do a 2 weeks there before you kick out on any missions, and you get all the local stuff. And then you start training your dog just on that local stuff. So you kind of run through the basics. We do boxes. So when I go overseas, we always go back to the basics, and I'll run that new odor from overseas just to make sure he's tracking that this is a new area with new scents, but the same odor that you're looking for, that you look for in the States, but it's just going to smell a little different. It might smell like, you know, a little bit like shawarmas, you know?
Well, and the boxes you're talking about too, just to kind of paint a picture, because I remember, obviously, when I met Jesse, that was actually about the time I got my first squirrel pup. So I immediately started picking his brain about anything dog. And I actually tried your boxes. So the boxes that you're referring to are the ones, you know, you were telling me build two boxes, make them look the same, drill some holes in it, you know, put the scent in it, work with them on one box, get the reaction you want, add another box, teach the dog to show you which box that scent is in. That's the boxes you're referring to when you say you did boxes when you deployed, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's at the very beginning stage. You know, by the time we get our dogs back from school, we're our basics for us would be the four boxes already, right? Your goal is to get up to the four boxes. You just have to, you know, baby steps with dogs. Successive approximation is what we call it. So you have to start, you want to start off slow, you know, so you want to do the one box, and you're teaching him, hey, this is what we're doing. This is the behavior I want. And this is what I expect to get out of you. So you start that with the one box, but anyway, so we run four boxes. They have holes about the size of a, you know, softball on top, maybe a tennis ball, maybe a little bit bigger. And they got a little place in the back that's open. We usually use rubber so we can, you know, put our hides in there. Sometimes it'll be closed off. We just put the odor down through the top of the hole, just off in the corner. You just want to make sure when you're using the boxes, the hole's not big enough that the dog can see the object in the box. Because dogs are cheaters, and they want to get that tennis ball, right? That's their reward. They just got to get all of this tennis ball. So you have to always make sure. That's why you always go back to the basics. You're always checking your dog to make sure he's not false sitting or doing anything, just trying to get away with something. So if he can see the object through the hole, they're going to cheat, right? You want him to be just smell it. That's what you're going for. So we have four boxes. You always have you always put your odor in there, and you mix the boxes around. You bring your dog out, and then you cast him to each box. You know, as he gets better, you can kind of back off a little bit as he gets the game, but you're casting him, and then when he finds the right box, he sits down, stares at the hole in the box, and that's where we get that sit and stare. That comes from the boxes. I want you to sit and stare at the box, right? Because he's found source. He got his nose as close to source as he possibly can. That's kind of how we grow that. And it's always the basic for us. You know, we take the boxes with us when we deploy. It's always the best thing to go back to. And, you know, I was there in Iraq, and we had this was Syria, I apologize. We had a interpreter that got a little religious really quickly on us and got a little weird and decided to leave camp. And he wanted to leave some stuff behind in the Connex, and it just made everybody nervous. So we had some cardboard boxes and some other stuff that he had, you know, all stored up that he didn't want to leave. Well, as we had talked about this kind of, you know, privately, and the goal was to, like, get this guy outside the gate and then, you know, have him in the truck and then have me search this guy's, you know, stuff prior to storing it for him, you know, because you never know. And so I, with that opportunity, I was like, well, how do I want to run him on these, you know, on these number of boxes this guy was storing stuff in? And I was like, oh, just run it like boxes, you know, just go back to the basics. And I did that. And that was, I think I was 2 weeks into that deployment, and I'm standing there with a guy, a big, tall, lanky guy. I can't remember his name, but we're sitting there together, and he's watching me, and I cast Priest to go search these boxes, and he goes one box, and he goes to the next box, and he goes to the third box, and he goes to the fourth, and he comes back to the third, and he sits and stares at the box. I'm like, oh, man, I hope he found something, because this is going to make me look real bad, right? I'm 2 weeks in country, you know? I'm a little worried about this right now. So the guy, I like, you know, this is also my first time running a dog. I'm deployed. I'm all by myself at this point, you know. And he sits, and I like paused a little longer than I should have. And the dude turned, looked at me, and said, "Well, that's not good, is it?" I was like, "It's not great." So I brought it back, and I was like, "Let me just confirm this." And I cast him one more time. He went right back to the same box, and sat again. And I had to call it up. So I called EOD over there and said, "Hey, there's something in this box right here." And then, you know, of course, we got to take some precautions at that point. We have all this, you know, lining up, and we got to make sure there's nothing serious in there. So EOD goes out, and they move the box to a different corridor and camp there where it's safe. And they bring a robot out, and they pull the cover off, and they pull everything out and kind of stack it all around. And they said they didn't find anything. You know, I'm like, "Oh God, here, I'm going to look, we're going to look bad." I was like, "Come on, priest, I trust you, man. You know, I know you got this." So I said, "Well, let me just take him out and everything's laid out. Let me let him run it again and see where he stops." And he goes around, he's running, and he goes up to a shoebox and stops, smells it, and sits down. And I was like, "Okay, it's in the shoebox." So now everybody's super nervous, you know? And now I'm super worried, because I'm like, "Really, I hope there's something in there." So they pop open this box, and he found 30 AK-47 rounds.
Wow.
Black powder.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Through the cartridge. So found that, and that led us to question him about why he had AK rounds. We found out that he had taken a AK from us that he was going to take and sell on the streets.
Oh, so he got muzzle thumped.
So he got in a little bit of trouble after that. So we got the AK back, and that all paid off. It made Priest look like a rock star right out the gate, because he was. And it was all set from there. I was sitting around one day. The guys from Rocca came over, because Rocca was a little bit more of a mess. You know, there's still a bunch of IEDs around there. It was still ISIS cells everywhere. And I come in and said, "Hey, we're trying to get this guy out of a tunnel, and we don't know how to get him out of the tunnel. Like, what do we, you know? We're trying to come up with a game plan." And I had just overheard this, and I went up to the sergeant major. I said, "Man, I got a dog that'll pull that guy right out of the tunnel." Yeah, <okay. laughs> you know, I said. And he was like, "Can he really?" I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "I'll hook up a, you know, 50-foot lead or whatever." I was like, "Let him get a hold of that dude. I'll drag him out with the dog, you know." And I was first thing we could do, which is not very realistic at all. So don't get me wrong there. I was just amped up trying to get this job, you know. But I said, "Yeah." I said, "And you know, I just make him bark, you know, too, outside the tunnel. Maybe it'll scare the dude out, you know." And he's like, "Oh, okay." So the team picked me up. I went to Rocca. I was getting ready to go to Rocca that next day. Well, my dog did not know how to bark on command. I hadn't taught him that. You know, he had no idea. So I was like, "I got to figure this out." So it took. Thank God, Priest was such. He was so easy to train. He was such a reliable dog. It took me about 15 minutes to get him to bark on command, and we had it down. And we went and did that tunnel mission. I was there in Rocca after that. Ever since.
So you got the guy out of the tunnel.
Yeah, we went there. We went to the tunnel.
Did Priest get him out, or did the bark get him out? I got to know that.
Guy wasn't in the tunnel. Guy wasn't in the tunnel. But when we got there, we were walking up to it. I said, "Hey, let me clear this out real quick." And Priest went up to it, and he had found he had signaled on it. There was something there at the entrance of the tunnel. EOD came in, and there was a bunch of propellant where they were taking propellant out of some of the IEDs that they had found. Out of some of the mortars they have found to make you know, their own IEDs out of them. So there was a bunch of propellant there that he signaled on. So we had another hit there. Never ended up being a guy in that tunnel. But yeah. We did a little tunneling while we were there. I shouldn't have, but you know, I wanted to get a little bit of tunnel rat in. And so me and Priest been through a couple tunnels. We never ran into anybody, luckily, but yeah, got the experience in. It's a different kind of war zone. It's not like Nazi Germany. You know, it's you go, you know, not that I was there by all means, but it's a different type of warfare. You can't just walk into any building, you know, without the threat of something blowing up. You know, you got to be very careful about where you go. So it's, you know, having a dog there is, you know, I had deployed on a team prior to that. Nobody mentioned a dog. You know, we should every team that goes, you know, should have a dog with them. Why not? You know what I mean? I can't say how many 50 some fines. I can't say how many times that dog probably saved our life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
you know,
so on the bite portion of it, I guess, are they supposed to hold a person, or, you know, what are they supposed to try to do on that?
Yeah, so the bite stuff we want them to hold is what group wants. Group wants them to hold. Essentially, you're holding the guy down there till we get there, right? Because you never know what kind of distance you're working with when you send a dog off to go bite somebody. You know, if he's got to chase him down for a minute, the guy gets in the build, the dog goes in. You want him to hold and detain the guy. That's really all you're going to get. You know, you want him just to. It's still just a dog at the end of the day. You know, I mean, if the guy goes for a gun or goes for the knife, what's going to happen? Who knows? You know, but it's a lot of pain you're in when the dog's on you. So you don't really have the reaction of like, well, I'll just pull a knife out. When the dog's on your arm, you're just trying to get the dog off your arm. Yeah. You're not thinking about, let me grab something. You know what I mean? Let me grab something to get this thing off me. You're just panicking at that point. So we want them. Now, my dog Priest, he had the tennis ball is great, but it's bad because it's like steel wool over time. You know, it's like sandpaper. And it does kind of wear at their teeth. And he had broken a canine and the other one's kind of wore down. So Priest was a little gnarlier when it came to biting. When he would bite, he would try to hold to the best of his ability, but he would kind of come off. He'd just pull off, you know, because his teeth weren't really, you know, them two big canines sink in, they're grabbing and holding. Well, his one little broken canine, the other wore down one, would grab you, and then he would just pull off of you. So on a real person, I mean, to me, it's so much worse to have a dog just tearing at you as opposed to biting and holding. Because then as the dog comes off, he's biting the next thing you present. So if you're going for, you know, you're going for a weapon or you're going for something else, there's a better chance of him grabbing that other arm or, you know, I mean, it's half a dozen. But, he was definitely very brutal. You know, if he got on a real bite, it would be pretty horrific to watch, you know.
You telling me that some of your other handling buddies would kind of tease you that your dog wouldn't hold bite, and you were like, no, wait a minute, let's think about this.
If your dog bites,
it sucks, but if my dog bites, there's not a lot of your arm left when he's done.
If I walk in real slow,
he's going to turn you to roast beef.
Yeah, and they're all unique biters, you know. They all have their own different personalities. They're all better at other things than, you know, other things. And I remember we had a female dog, Mika. Her thing was that she would jump super high. And I mean, she would get a shoulder bite. You know, when you're out there in a bite suit, you're in a jacket with a little bit of collar on there, but your neck's exposed, your face is exposed. I can't say how many times this dog jumped up, just face right next to you, dug into your shoulder. You know, she's always a jump biter. Some dogs go after your legs. You know, we want to train them to hit you in the right spots. But some dogs are just fixated on other things, so it's harder to get them off of, you know, if you got like a dog that's going after the legs, you don't necessarily want that. You want to train them to take the arm or take something that's coming at them, you know.
I never really thought about that until you were just given that scenario about, you know, once the dog is on you and you're, you know, once the dog is on the other guy and you're coming in, you know, and him going for a knife or a gun. I never really even thought on why they train so much on arms, but that actually makes a boatload of sense. Because, you know, if you're on my leg, I might get to a knife or a gun. But if you're on my arm, I'm now a one-armed guy. And I'm completely going to go for the dog, I think. I don't think I would even consider a gun.
Just out of reaction, yeah. And what do you do when something's coming at you? What do you always put out in front of you?
Your hands, arms, absolutely.
Your hands, yeah. Yeah, that's why, you know, 90% of snake bites are on the hands. Because people always got to reach out and touch it.
Well, snakes ain't going to bite me, right, Chad? I got too much garb.
Again, they're going to bite him in the back.
Chad always – we saw a rattlesnake at LBL, and he likes to tease me about all the stuff I put on now. So we go
out to LBL, and he almost steps on a rattlesnake. It didn't rattle. It's pretty cold, you know. And we got ready to go this year, and he pulls out, you know, knee boots and – then he puts on some gaiters, and then he puts on some chaps, and I don't know how he's covered. Packing all the woods. I'm saying, what are you doing? Snakes ain't gonna get me.
Nope. They will not. They'll be disappointed if they bite me.
So going back just a little bit on finding the scent, I guess to tie it into the squirrel dogs, they're using winding ability. So we love it when our prize dogs can find squirrels that's never hit the ground, just off the wind or off the scent coming down. So basically all these dogs are working off winding ability, I guess, right?
A little bit of everything. It depends on the environment we're working in, right? You know, like if we're outside, you know, you want to play the wind in your favor. right? Because the scent's rolling with the wind. If you're in a, you know, if you're inside a building, you know, air naturally pulls outside of the bottom of doors or a window if it's open, and you know, it falls down vents and down lockers and down the wall. And so you want to, you know, as a handler, your job, you're half the equation. You know, your dog can find the scent, but your job is to put him in those productive areas to then be able to find it. So it's a real team effort. And, you know, when we're outside, the air scenting, yeah, it's wherever they can find it. You know, I mean, if wherever the scent is, if the scent's high, you know, and that comes to the training too. We train multiple different ways. You know, I think it's a little, we probably defer a little bit, you know, in how we're training, because you guys are probably always have scent coming down, right? I'm assuming you're always looking up in the trees.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, a lot of it has to do with thermals and stuff, which would probably help you all the opposite way. You know, we are looking for thermals coming down where you would probably be looking for thermals coming up. You know, a buried IED or something that's ground level, so you want that scent to come up a little bit.
Yeah, if it's forest ground, yeah, it's going to come up through there. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, yeah, and it's actually, you know, ironically, the high hides is more advanced training, right? The ground stuff is easy. So you guys are jumping in, and you're actually teaching your dog to do something that's an advanced stage for even a military working dog. You know, for we start at ground level and then we work into doing high hides, you know, because as scent, you know, the more room scent has to fall and travel, the harder it is for the dog to track down. So you guys are already training kind of at the peak of scent. You know, if they're smelling something coming down from a tree that's 20 feet, 30, you know, 20 feet or so up, you know, up high, you know, you guys are doing really good. You know, that's a big deal in it. So I think you guys probably, when it comes to training, should, maybe consider giving yourselves a little more credit. You know, that's definitely an advanced move to get a high hot.
Yeah, and our dogs are normally doing that. I've seen some of my dogs, you know, find a squirrel, wind a squirrel at 120 yards. They've got that. They can do pretty good on that part.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, I mean, it is. It's really impressive at the end of the day. You know, they use canines in prisons to find cell phones. You know, I mean, you could literally train a dog on any scent that you could come up with, you know, and some that you can't even smell. You know, that whole stew theory where, you know, if you walk in, you smell stew cooking. If a dog walks in, he smells the basil and the tomatoes and the garlic and every last little thing. It's their olfactory system is really, it's impressive. It's impressive. I'd say one of the differences in our fields probably is to the, you know, the how we train. You know, we're probably a little harsher than your realm. You know, we use chain collars. We do leash corrections. You know, we have to really make sure our dog is paying attention to us and is following what we're doing. It's a little, you know, I'm not saying your job, you know, what you guys do is lax by all means. I'd say we probably do a little bit, you know, it's probably a little harsher of a training situation than for what you guys do.
Yeah. Well, I got a couple handlers I could introduce you to.
Well, you know, I take them. I trained with some old bird dog guys, and they were pretty harsh too. But
we interviewed one of them.
Yeah.
Did you? True. Yeah. Yeah, the old pinch the ear guys, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, y'all are also in a lot higher stress situation, you know, than we are. Which yeah, some of these competitions get stressful, but not life or death stressful.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you were out and you know, when you and Priest were out on a mission, as far as what did that look like? You know, what was your primary objective on the team? Whether you were moving through a town or and mainly on the bomb scent thing, you know, not every scenario where he's got to go bite somebody or kick a door in, but you had told me before, you talk about energy running down the leash, you know, and you're moving through in a convoy and you get to an IED area, and just the one story that always sticks out in my mind, or the one thing you said, was energy traveling down the leash and trying to keep the dog excited. You know, you don't want the dog to feel your nervousness or whatever. And it was just funny to me because you're out there looking for IDs and you're telling, you know, come on, Priest, good boy, come on, let's go find it, where's it at, where's it, you know. And
party voice.
Yeah, and inside you got to be sweating bullets, you know, like I hope he finds it before I step on it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a very good point. And it really does. And it'll give you a good idea of how that emotion does run down the leash. You know, I remember one time where, you know, there was one time I didn't handle it great. And I saw my dog react and I was like, oh yeah, that's for sure. I hyped him up. We were, we were on the line there and we got a little bit of a tick. We were shooting some orders and stuff. And we got over the radio somebody had shot a missile at us. And, we're in a MATV, which is just a jacked up Humvee, which looks really cool, but it's not as stout as I came to learn it was, you know. it can't take quite a hit like I thought it could in the past. But anyway, we got that on the radio. So we all immediately, you know, just instant reactions. You just got to everybody's got to jump out of the car or out of that MATV as quick as they can. So we bust the doors open and we all kind of bail out of there. You know, if they're aiming at that thing, hopefully it just hits that and goes by us or whatever, you know. So we got out when we jumped out. Priest jumped out, and we were all super amped. None of it made any sense to the dog because all of a sudden everybody's emotions in the vehicle change. We jump out. Everybody's like, oh, you know, get down. And Priest starts jumping around. He's getting nervous. Like, what's going on? He's looking for somebody to bite. You know, like, what's going on, guys? Who do you want me to go after? And I had to be like, okay, just like, hey, it's cool. Relax. You know, it's okay, Priest. No big deal. Yeah, no matter, you know. I'd be walking, you know, it's always the dog, me, and then EOD walking behind me, you know? So it's like, I'm not wanting anything or like, I'm not looking for, I'm just hoping my dog is not leading me in the right direction. You know, you got to trust your dog, you know? So, EOD doesn't have to, which is why they're behind me with their metal detectors, you know, searching for stuff. But, as they walk where I just walked, but, yeah, a lot of trust in your dog, a lot of trust in your dog for sure.
So you hopped out with Priest on a leash then. How long is that lead? How much lead do you give a dog looking for bombs?
Good question. So the average leash is you know, we run a lot of 30 footers when you're deployed. I bumped up to a 50 footer when I was deployed, but the whole time, the majority of the time that I deployed, I ran with just the collar, was just the shock collar. And really didn't need that just for the beeps or whatever. I had all that laid out, if I wanted to come back, one beep type of deal. But that's it. I ran them off leash most of the time because we were just, our training was up there. By the time I deployed, I could cast them off. I mean, he would be 200 meters. He'd get 200 meters ahead of me searching a road. I could send him out. He'd search the left side and come back towards me and search the right side and then say, what's up, and go back out again, you know? So, which to me, that's the only way to do it. You know, 50, I don't know about you, but 50 feet isn't enough for me.
No, I'm sitting here thinking they didn't make like 250 feet leashes.
Isn't that right? Well, then what do you do? Where do you put it? And then how do you manage it while you're working the dog? You know, the longer the leash, the more stuff you got slinging around you. And I got all my kit and all my gear, plus the stuff I need to have for the dog. And then the dog got all his gear on. You know, so when we get ready for a mission, I got to dress myself and I got to dress my little canine too and get put all his gear on. So
it doesn't take much of an IED to rattle you at 50 feet.
not at all. Not enough for me.
So in the dog world, of course, we obviously run in the hunting dog world, I should say, we obviously run wireless collars, GPS collars. So I got to know, does the U.S. military run Dogtra or Garmin?
Ooh, so I won't say the U.S. military because group and fifth group specifically, we get to kind of pick, you know, like we switched foods while we were there. We kind of, you know, we worked with what we got. Dogtra was what we were using when I was there. And I loved the Dogtra collar. It's very simple. I'm not saying it's the best thing on the market. Not saying it's the worst thing. Just because the Army uses Colt M4s doesn't mean that they're the best. They were the cheapest, you know?
everything you work with is made by the cheapest bidder.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, exactly.
Well, Garmin needs to get a little cheaper on them then. I'm a Garmin fan, but I've never run Dogtra, so I have no idea. I'm sure they're great.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I came up with that idea for the app that where you could just – I said, we got Google Maps. Why can't I just go on Google Maps and then put a imaginary fence circle around with a line, and then when the collar goes off a GPS, when it gets to a certain point, it like the collar goes off. And I should have patented that out a little sooner because I believe they got something out like that now.
Yeah, that is one thing I do like about the Dogtra hunting collars that, you know, the people run it. It runs off of your phone is your handheld, which the Garmin collar that I run has a Garmin handheld that connects to the collar. And that is one thing I like about Dogtra is it runs off Google Maps. So to get all that bird's eye crap from Garmin, you have to pay them, of course.
Oh, yeah. Gotta get that app.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to, you know, hook it up to your computer or buy the map card or whatever. But so I will give Garmin or Dogtra that. They had that part figured out. And maybe they do it now. I want them to run it on the Onyx app, where you get property lines, you get everything right there with your dog location.
Yeah.
Maybe
you know Dogtra's, exactly where you should be hunting.
Yeah, maybe Dogtra's doing that already, but with the property line issues that hunting dog people have to deal with, it would be great to have Onyx hook up. My preference would be with Garmin, not Dogtra, but it would be cool to see that marriage so that we could see all that. If, you know, yeah, on the off chance Garmin's listening, I won't charge you anything for that idea.
That just cuts my hunting down.
If you then it takes away the, oh, I didn't know I stepped over that fence. It was down.
Exactly. So, I can't play stupid.
Chad, you just got us all in trouble now. Well, Jesse, we've had you on the phone for a long time, and I do apologize, but we appreciate everything you're saying. But there is one part of the show that is Chad's favorite part of the show.
So I have to get a story out of people, and I've got two notes here. Actually, it's kind of one, but I guess a suggestion for the funny story was kind of goes back to what I like to do, competition, right? And I understand you was in a competition at one time, and can you tell us how that went?
Yeah, so I know exactly what you're talking about. So I was at, I had just gotten back from Syria, okay? And keep in mind, you know, we had, before we finished up there, we crossed the flot, you know, when we pushed the northern ISIS out of Syria, ISIS out of northern Syria. We got in a big tick there. We had mortars coming at us. We're playing Frogger for a bunch of hours. You know, Priest and I almost got taken out with one of those suckers, the first one they shot at us. And so I had that whole background, right? 50-some fines, very, very intense 6 months, heavy, you know, full speed for 6 months, getting stuff done. So I come back and we go to the Canine Olympics and at Vaughn Lake Kennels there. And we were doing one objective there where it was just an open field, and it was like an LZ, this little landing zone, you know, is what it was going to be. And you had to go out there, you had to clear the landing zone so the bird, the theoretical bird could land, you know, out there. And I was like, me and Priest got this. I'm going to smoke this, right? So we go out there and I just cast Priest out off leash. I'm like, go Suke. That was our word for search. He took off, went straight to the bomb, sat down, and I rewarded him. And I was like, all right. And I grabbed Priest and I just walked off. And then Todd, my other buddy, was going by me to run it, right? He does his thing. I'm back by the truck feeling good about myself, right? We just crushed this. I mean, it took Priest no time to find this bomb, right? I was like, I aced this one. And Todd comes back and he's like, hey man, he's like, what do you do? What'd you do out there? And I was like, I found it. I was like, I caught, there's a bomb out there. I was like, that's it, we found it. And he's like, no man, there was more than one. He's like, there was multiple bombs you had to find. And I was like, bro, it's an LZ. If I found a bomb, we're not landing there. We're picking a new place. And he said, yeah, I figured you'd say that. He's like, I told the guy you just got back from deployment. and he completely understood where you're coming from. So, yeah, didn't pass that one.
I bet the judge on that one was probably like, where is that guy going? There's no bombs over there.
I was in my head. Yeah, and I was in my head the whole time, too. So apparently he was yelling at me like, hey, where are you going? Where are you going? I'm just walking off just like, yeah, I crushed it. Good job, Priest.
That goes back to know the rules.
That's right. Yep.
But, you know, I kind of feel like they set you up there a little bit, too. You know, because I've never done a bomb dog competition, but I'm totally with you. If there's one bomb, I'm not landing there, you know?
No. Nobody's got time to go in there and pick the bomb up and then hopefully there's no more. No, he moved to a new place.
Yeah. But you were talking about, too, you know, dogs sitting and staring, and I forgot to mention this when we were on that, but I had a squirrel dog, actually, that would tree and sit and stare until Chad hit him in the head with a squirrel and totally snapped him out of that. But I don't know, Chad, maybe that was a problem. Maybe Smoke was actually born to be a bomb dog instead of a squirrel dog.
I tell you, I love that look and stare, man. I think you guys are missing out.
He did that.
He was looking, staring up the tree, and he had winded the squirrel. He just didn't know what to do when he winded it. And I had shot a squirrel and had it in my back in my bag, you know, and Devin's like, well, what do we do here? He's done this before. And I was like, well, Devin, you just shoot up there and I'll throw the squirrel where he can't see me and get his confidence up. You know, once you build his confidence, he'll start barking, I believe. And he shot up there and I threw that squirrel a little harder than I thought. And it smacked him right in the back of the head. And the very next tree, he winded and barked on it.
And I swear, after that, at least in my memory, after that, the switch was on. I mean, it's like, I don't know, he got hit in the head with that squirrel, and all of a sudden he knew exactly what to do. He's like, oh, yeah, maybe it is up there.
And I didn't right Devin for that training session.
Yeah, just the right timing for that to happen, for it to click in his brain.
I would definitely say you two, with dogs, you two, I've probably picked y'all's brain to pieces. I mean, y'all are definitely the, you know, and I even tried some of that stuff that Jesse gave me. Like, I tried the boxes, and the only thing, of course, I'm a complete idiot at that point, and still an idiot at this point, but the only thing with the boxes, I couldn't figure out a way to transition that into a tree dog. You know, I didn't really want him to, I wanted him to bark at the box. So when I did the boxes, I always like had them placed near a tree in my yard. But it may have helped him on scent a little bit, but it definitely didn't help him on his bark. That's for sure. We had to hit him in the head with a squirrel to get him to bark.
Yeah, I guess that's probably where you got it from then. I'd say it'd be easier to take what I know with the boxes and transfer it over to what you guys are doing as opposed to the other way around. It would be difficult for you to figure out how to use the boxes in that frame, you know. You got to be a little creative, I'd imagine, because you're wanting a different, you know, you're not wanting that sit and stare, so you'd have to mix it up a little bit for sure.
Absolutely. Well, Devin's kind of transitioned on that already. He hangs a squirrel tail up in a tree, and of course, we do that too, kind of hang a dead squirrel or tail up in the woods and let them go find it. So, you know, instead of four boxes, they've got 100 trees, and they got to find which one has the scent in it. So, you know, we kind of use some of the same techniques, really. If you think about it, it's all the same.
Yeah. I mean, their drives are their drives, you know. The dogs will be dogs, you know. So all their drives are the same. We're doing it all the same for the most part, I'd say. You know, it just looks a little different, but the, you know, what we're going after when we're tugging at their drives, and, you know, sex, air, food, water, you know, we're tugging at those, we're getting the same thing out of them.
It would be kind of nice or kind of neat to go to some kind of formal training. And, you know, I tell everybody, they ask how I train a squirrel dog, and I was like, well, I don't think I really train. I just give them the opportunity. It would be nice to go to some kind of formal training course and learn some of those techniques to use. I think it would probably help.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe like just even the odor side of it too, you know, like if you get into like some odor theory with a course like that, as far as canines are concerned, that could definitely, I would say that'd be beneficial for you guys to, you know, really, I'm sure you know where to look and stuff like that, but as far as how that odor moves and all that stuff, would be very, very helpful for you guys too.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that you had trained with some really nationally and world renowned bird dog guys. And I can kind of see more of a connection to y'all's world with a bird dog being more stealthy and slow and focused and, you know, lots of nose power and, you know, bird dog will point where y'all want to sit and stare reaction. And it's a lot of groundwork, obviously, with bird dogs and bomb dogs, drug dogs, whatever kind of dog, where, like Chad said, ours is a lot of air work.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We, and also like a lot of the obedience as far as like the casting the dog where you want him to go, a lot of that stuff transitions over quite well too. You know, you want the dog to be out, and if you want the dog to go search a building to the left, you want to be able to cast them over to the left. So that all kind of fits that bill too.
Yeah.
And that's what we use, you know, the civilian guys, you know, that we trained under, that was kind of what we brought those guys in for. We're specifically for teaching us the directionals and helping us get better at that stuff. You know, we had our bite guys that would come in specifically for a bite, and then, you know, more obedient stuff with different guys. So yeah, a lot of opportunity, but a lot of knowledge out there, a lot of good old dudes, that definitely have a lot of knowledge in this field for sure. You can spend a lifetime, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And still not learn it all.
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah. Like I said, we'll never know until we get behind the eyes of a dog. You only know so much, you know.
appreciate you coming on. We both do. And kept you on the phone a little longer than I told you we would, but it's just a lot of dog talk, and it was all real interesting.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. It was good to look back. It's been a little while. I'm a little rusty. It's been a little while since I talked about all that. But, yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. And always here.
Talk about wrenching on Harleys.
Let's do it. We could have a hold of the podcast about that. We can change your followers up a little bit.
That's right.
As long as I don't have to deal with the customers, I'm fine.
There you go. Hey, yep, exactly right.
All right, Jesse. Well, we will let you get to your night. It's already getting late, so I'm going to go feed a dog and actually got to do a little work. Anyway, we appreciate you coming on, and again, thank you for your service. Thank you, Chad, and thank any veteran listening for their service, and hopefully the ones listening, you know, kind of at least find this bomb dog episode. It's a little different than what we normally do, but hopefully the ones listening can take something from it. Or at least just open their eyes to a whole different type of working dog and how they're trained and how they work and the people behind them.
Heck yeah. Well, I appreciate that, and Chad. It's good talking to you guys, and let's do it again sometime.
All right.
Don't you.
See you.
All right, bye, guys.